Hello, I'm Jad Abumrad, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. Anyone who has watched the movie Star Trek, what's the other one with Steve Guttenberg? I can't remember the name right now, but anyone who's seen these movie depictions of robots and dreamed of a world where robots could perhaps do things for us, like clean our cat litter, or even talk to us or laugh with us, well, that dream got a little closer to reality in the 90s, thanks to a robot named Kismet. Well, this is a robot that talked, that if you said the right things to it, it would respond. It could bat its eyelids and do all kinds of various things. And I'm very happy to have with me the person who brought Kismet into the world, Cynthia Brazil. Very nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell me, you're not just a robot maker. Can you give me sort of your more official title?
My official job is a professor.
Okay, at MIT.
At the MIT Media Lab, that's
where
correct.
All of these sort of things seem to emanate from.
much of these things certainly seem to emanate from MIT.
So before we get to what you do, just sort of picking up on what Brian Greene was talking about, we're talking about the World Science Festival and maybe some of the problems that science is facing in trying to communicate increasingly complicated things to the layperson. I wonder, you as a woman in science, I wonder what your perspective on where you see the role of women in science. Is it trending up or down, or is it as it always was? I know it's an overly general question, but I wonder what you think.
Yeah, so I think for women in science and in general, I think it really depends on the discipline. So I think for some it's quite good, but in mine, which is computer science, engineering. Electrical engineering, the numbers are still quite low. They need to be much higher. we seem to be hovering around 15%. The numbers of women choosing an undergraduate major in computer science was dropping for a while. I don't know what the last statistics were this year, but I think it's still hovering around 10 to 15%, and clearly we need to do much better.
Yeah, my mother is a scientist, and what she tells me is that you see a lot of women entering science, but not a lot of women staying in science. Has that been what you've seen?
I think that is the concern of the trend is, say within the undergraduate years, you have, decent representation. Again, it depends on the field. But as you go higher and higher to graduate school, to faculty positions, you see fewer and fewer. I think there is now very real awareness and effort in trying to change that. I think part of the first challenge was just recognizing that this is an issue that something needs to be done about. I'm at MIT. There have been a number of policies that have been recently enacted to try to make it just more I wouldn't say easier because it's not easy, but just more friendly, let's say, more possible for women to succeed in performing, becoming a tenured faculty. There's just many challenges that women face in terms of, if they want to have a family and so forth. Those are the prime tenure track years when you are really working your very hardest. And I think, a number of institutions are really trying to be aware of that and evoke policies and so forth that make it just much more doable, I think, for women to succeed.
So let's talk about Kismet. Briefly, if you don't mind, I don't have the picture in front of me, but it's essentially it looks like an erector set with big eyes and a big sort of trumpet ears on the side and big lips that sort of flap. It's often talked about as the first sociable robot.
Robot, yeah.
How was Kismet, and perhaps some of the stuff you're working on now, how are these robots social? What does that exactly mean?
Yeah, so this field of social robotics and human robot interaction, it's a very new field. So, Kismet was the first. I finished that work.
Is it a he or a she, by the way?
Well, so it's an it. Robots don't have gender. But that work was defended, in 2000. So, we're talking about just a very exciting time in that there's a lot of promise and a lot of excitement and, a lot of future possibilities, but we don't exactly really know what they all are going to be yet.
Mm-hmm. How did Kismet, I'm curious, when you look at the robot, how was he looking back at you? Did he have cameras behind his eyes?
So when we talk about a social robot, the thing that was really different about Kismet, there's a number of things that were really different about Kismet. Kismet was really designed explicitly to explore, well, so research questions, but related to face-to-face interpersonal communication. There's much more human-like and embodied that had been done previously with, say, just pure language-based sorts of interfaces. So really bringing in the importance of the body and how technologies can communicate with us. And from an artificial intelligence perspective, which was really motivating this work, I was very inspired to understand what is the nature of these very special interactions that transpire between mothers and their infants that are so critical for that infant's cognitive and social development. And, you know, humans are incredibly socially sophisticated. I mean, the chances of us being able to program all of that right in is a daunting task. So another approach would be, well, can we bootstrap it? Can we have the robots acquire this social intelligence, trying to mirror the way that people do? And of course, you know, we, through our infancy and childhood, go through a tremendous developmental period. And it just speaks to how sophisticated this competence really is.
That's interesting. So it's not simply, I mean, in asking how can a robot react, it's not a series of if-then statements that you have to program.
It's absolutely not.
If you say hello, then robot says, well, hello, how are you? It's not like that. It's about what exactly?
It's really
learning?
About, yeah, so it's really about when you think about what is social intelligence, well, there's many facets to that. One aspect is that, you know, people's behavior is not just governed by physics. It's governed by having a mind. Mind with rich mental states like beliefs, goals, intentions, desires, motives. And we understand each other and can predict and explain each other's behaviors along these terms. And that's critical because that allows us to coordinate behavior. So things like communication, learning from one another, teamwork, these are all, you know, enabled by the fact that we can coordinate minds in part through coordinating our bodies. So a lot of what I think is a core scientific question for social robots is how do you design robots that can interact and understand people in terms of having a mind as opposed to just physical action. So
what does that mean exactly though?
So in psychology, this ability is called theory of mind or mind reading. And so, you know, in one aspect, you can imagine one of the challenges is how do you build a robot that has a theory of mind?
That knows that you are thinking something and that knows
that can understand your behavior in terms of basically your mental state. So the relation of seeing versus knowing. Mm-hmm. For you to be aware of something, say in a scene that's changing, I know that you will have had to have seen it. So I know there's a connection between, you know, the sensory input through your eyes and the internal state of knowledge or awareness. So, I mean, these are effortless. People do this effortlessly. This is how we understand soap operas, you know, through all the body right. language and glancing and so forth, through our facial expressions. Again, it's an incredibly sophisticated competence, and it's a tremendous challenge to try to build robots that can really understand people in this sort of same sort of way. You know, and again, if you can achieve that, then, you know, building robots that can communicate more richly, more sophisticatedly, to be able to learn new tasks and skills from people through imitation or demonstration or tutelage. I mean, all of these become possible. There's many just other mechanisms to use, like empathy, a more experiential embodied way we have of relating to one another. There's, you know, phenomenon of like emotional contagion. There's many ways we use to communicate, to bring our internal states, our feelings, our thoughts, and so forth into alignment. And it is, you know, it's an intriguing scientific question on how you could create technologies or machines that could do that. But there's a lot of very interesting possible applications for those kinds of technologies if you could successfully understand that and do that.
I'm Jad Abumrad talking with the robot expert and MIT professor, Cynthia Brazil. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Let me ask you this, though. If what you're describing generally is trying to create a machine that can, to some degree, read one's mind or sort of know what someone else is thinking and also learn, how do you go about engineering the people to want to teach the robots? Because, I mean, when a baby comes into the world, it's brand new, but it's been engineered somehow to be cute and for us to have a deep emotional attachment to this creature. But with a machine, we might not necessarily have the patience to teach it. I mean, I wonder, what do you have to do from the robot's perspective to make us want to spend time with it?
So, I mean, you're absolutely, you know, you have a good point there. So what we do is we look to developmental psychology. What are the characteristics and behaviors of children, of infants, that really sort of push our social buttons to want to be motivated to engage in this? Not only because it's compelling, but because it's enjoyable for you. I mean, I think people, in many ways, we're natural teachers. We enjoy teaching. We're also natural learners. We often, you know, certainly as children, we learn a lot through play. The challenge is, how do you create a robot that can fit into that system? The robot that's, you know, that can learn from the ways that people naturally want to teach it in a way that's rewarding for people to teach it, so they want to teach it. Similarly, you can't, you know, build robots that take forever to learn. So it has to be able to learn in sort of natural human timescales from natural human interactions. And I think, I mean, one of the big challenges is, you know, designing these robots that really can learn from anyone. Because if you look at the state of, you know, machine learning techniques today, they're very sophisticated, but it's often, you know, the graduate students, professors, and specialists who design these algorithms to have these kinds of systems, you know, learn whatever they're designed to learn. But it's a very fundamentally different question about, how do you design a machine that grandma or little Sally can teach in a way that's natural and effortless?
Right.
You know, there's a whole bunch of social psychology and understanding interactions and the role of interaction and mediating learning and attention, all these cognitive processes that you have to understand in order to successfully build these kinds of systems. So psychology, developmental psychologists, natural systems, understanding, you know, what is the literature, what is the science of that to guide and inspire how you create these technologies is certainly a very rich source of information and inspiration, right, for these systems.
Just in the last few minutes that we have, as you look forward, what do you see as being the first robot that will truly be capable of learning? I mean, is that robot already around and we're just not aware of it? But in the near future, what will be the first? And perhaps in the far future, when your grandkids have grandkids and their robots will presumably be all around them, what kinds of machines will those be, in your opinion?
So the first question is obviously a very deep question, because it's getting to the very nature of what do we mean when we say that a machine would be learning? I mean, there are certainly machines that learn a variety of things that they're designed to learn, basically. But the challenge of, how do you build a robot that can, you know, learn in the wild, so to speak, that can really have a long longitudinal, I guess you'd call it a life cycle, that could continue to learn and accumulate experience, knowledge, and skills over that time period, of a long time period. I mean, that certainly remains a grand challenge. We have not certainly achieved that. And that is a fascinating question in terms of, what do we have to understand about how systems learn, how they structure their own learning problems for themselves, the role that people might take in guiding that learning. I mean, these are all very interesting questions that are certainly motivating a lot of my research, as well as those of others in my field. What was the other question?
The second part of the question was, I want you to sort of sci-fi look in the future and tell me what sorts of robots you imagine there will be. Will we, you know, certainly the sci-fi sort of nightmare fantasies come to mind, but putting those aside, I mean, I wonder where you see your research leading to when the third person in your scientific offspring is doing this kind of research.
Sure.
Where will that person be working on?
So, again, I mean, robotics, we're going through a very exciting period right now, in that we're starting to really try to crack this nut in terms of, how do you bring these technologies into everyday society versus sending it off to Mars or into the ocean, you know, these sort of scientific or remote tasks far from people. I think we will have a wide, wide range of robotic systems, and some of them you won't even think about as being robotic. And, you know, the key example of that right now is your car. We do not think of your car as being a robot, but arguably it has many robotic technologies, and it has sensors, computation, you know, and automatic braking systems is controlling your braking pedal. I mean, there's autonomy within that vehicle, and now with, you know, the grand challenges, DARPA Urban Challenge and so forth, you know, now they're starting to drive themselves as well. So there are going to be a number of devices. I think many of the ways that, you know, for artificial intelligence, we go, well, where is it? Well, the answer is, it's everywhere. It's in the internet. It's the way we plan flights and so forth. I think robotics will be, you know, successful also in the sense it will be almost invisible to us. We won't think of these things explicitly as being robots, but those technologies and techniques will be everywhere. you know, the big shift, I think, the paradigmic sort of shift that I think social robots brings is you know, right now robots are largely viewed as tools or machines that people operate explicitly. Social robot, it's more about robots that can really collaborate with us as partners. So robots that are our assistants that and this is why understanding mental states is so important. To coordinate joint action, you need to be able to do that. So, you know, I don't know when, but the next generations of social robots will probably interact with us more as teammates rather than as tools. And so if, you know, for me, you know, when I get to be an elderly person, you know, I don't want to sit on my butt and have a robot do all kinds of stuff for me, but I wouldn't mind having a robot around to help me prepare a meal because I still want to live my life. I still want to be as active as long as possible, but I wouldn't mind a helper, you know?
We need to leave it there in getting to the next segment, but I want to thank you for, I mean, this is certainly a conversation that can go on for many hours as to what those robots of the future will be. Cynthia Brazile has been my guest. Thank you so much for speaking with us. We have a link to your website, her website, on our show page, WNYC.org, if you want to learn more about her work and see pictures of Kismet. He's very cute. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.